Sometimes in life, change can be a catalyst for great things. In the case of Taylor Barnes, moving to a new city ultimately resulted in a successful future, but proved to be a hard transition.
And I moved down here, and it was just like some new kid, some New England Yankee kid, and I just got picked on and made fun of and ridiculed and bullied, and man, it was terrible. And so I got super pissed about moving to Atlanta. I thought this place sucked. I was like, get me out of here. And what that turned into was meeting the wrong friends. I gravitated towards the first people that really showed me some love, and they were bad people. I don't know how else to say it. They were involved in just bad, bad stuff. So I spent roughly 3 years in the dirt, as I call it. Got into drugs, got into stealing. Got into just really, really terrible, terrible behavior. At a young age, I mean, I was doing some pretty serious drugs when I was 14 years old, and that's just ridiculous. So I got kicked out of school my freshman year, and, you know, drug out of the class, arrested in public, the whole deal was terrible. So, you know, come home, and I've got this mother and father that just love me. You know what I mean? They've done nothing wrong here besides move us to this town, which was not a wrong thing to do. It's just, that's life, right? I just didn't adjust.
Also on this week's episode, we discuss how your past doesn't dictate your future, finding fulfillment by helping others, and pivoting your business with the progression of technology and trends. And now, episode 20 of Culturation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Are you ready? The main event of the evening.
The ideas.
It's the word that you put in.
The ability.
Can you dig it?
The talent.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
Those who influence, the entertainer, the business leader, and the entrepreneur, they're all right here on Culturation. And now, your host, Justin Epstein.
Welcome to Culturation. I'm your host, Justin Epstein. On this week's episode, we speak with the sales servant, Taylor Barnes. Taylor is Vice President of Global Business Development and a founding partner at Centrix IT. Barnes co-founded Centrix IT in 2007 and has since helped the organization become one of the fastest growing companies in Georgia and one of the top IT solution providers in North America. He currently manages business development for the services side of the organization, responsible for charting and maintaining an aggressive revenue growth plan. Centrix IT services revenue has grown by 400% since Barnes assumed sales leadership responsibility over the segment in 2014. Barnes was in his early 20s when he formed Centrix IT with his partners. His first role at the organization was as an IBM product specialist, brokering secondary market IBM equipment around the world. From there, he cut his teeth into the IT asset deposition space, creating the company's ITAD practice, which would mark the beginning of the organization's successful transition from an IT hardware reseller to a global comprehensive IT solutions provider. He moved into his current role in 2014, first as director before his promotion to vice president in 2017. Barnes' company, Centrix IT, is one of the top global exporters in Georgia, with offices in Toronto, Dubai, London, and Prague, and additional presence in more than 80 countries. The company has received the Globe Award, which honors its contributions to the state's global trade, from Governor Nathan Deal each year since 2013. Barnes is a road warrior, frequently traveling around the world to further develop the company's business worldwide. Husband to Brittany and father to Keller and Cyrus, he is active in the community and alongside his wife Brittany donates time, money, and resources to multiple causes close to his heart. With that being said, I would like to welcome my good friend Taylor Barnes to the show. Taylor, thanks for coming on today, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Epi.
So, you know, for those that may not be familiar with you and with your story, you know, we always try to get people in from different industries, different backgrounds. You being a thought leader and an innovator kind of in the IT space for almost 20 years now. Just kind of give people a little context about who you are and kind of a little bit of a background.
Yeah, sure thing. So I am originally from Weston, Connecticut, small little New England town up in Fairfield County. And I lived there, the mid-90s, and then I moved down here right before the Olympics, and I've been in Atlanta ever since. I went to Elon College up in North Carolina, which is now Elon University, funny enough, and it's like this Harvard of the South type of a school organization where I can promise you when I was there, it wasn't that. And then shortly after college, moved right back to Atlanta and got to work, and truly have been in the same exact industry ever since 2002. I was an intern. 2003, I went full-time. We were at our organization for about 4 or 5 years, And then we started our own company in 2007. That's Centrix IT. And we've evolved into a really large IT service delivery company. So basically delivering solutions anytime, anywhere, all over the world, from big time projects to on-demand engineering to hardware maintenance. And yeah, it's not like I studied any of this in college. And quite frankly, none of us did. But it was real lucrative in 2002, you know, coming off the dot bombs and all that. And so we fell in love with the industry, got familiar with it, learned how to run a business, and here we are.
Nice, man. So you grew up in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as a kid growing up in Connecticut, kind of what was some of your interest?
Yeah, sports, man. It was number one. So, you know, grew up in the woods, basically. It was, you know, we had a little over 2 acres and a lot of green grass, a lot of, flat line property. So that was really, really nice to be able to get out there and just run around, play sports, you know, just throwing the ball at all times. We had a basketball hoop, and gosh, it just the memories I have as a kid were really just around sports. But I really took to baseball and tennis; those were my two, and ended up getting really competitive into tennis, getting ranked in New England, started playing a lot of those regional tournaments, and almost considered taking that into high school and trying to get a ride to college and whatnot. But I ended up falling into it with baseball. And I played some pretty serious baseball up north and then brought that down here, ended up playing East Cobb ball and, got recruited, ended up playing in school, which was a very, very short-lived career going into D1. That was, quite frankly, impossible for me. Those boys were some serious ball players. So in Connecticut, sorry, long-winded answer, I would just say, man, I mean, it really just goes down to being outside at all times when there wasn't snow on the ground and playing sports every second of every single day.
Yeah, and it's funny. You talk to people, now you ask kids these days, do they go outside and play?
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time I've seen kids just like,
no,
go out and get dirty.
Yeah, mine included sometimes. You know what I mean? Like, I have to force it.
Yeah, and I remember going outside and our parents would like yell at us, like, you got to come in at some point.
That's right. That's right. They'd ring a bell or whatever they did or scream at you. And that's exactly right. It was completely normal and ordinary to do that back then. And nowadays, it's almost nerve-wracking as a parent to let them out of the house.
Yeah.
You know?
Nice. So sports was a big indicator.
It was.
Was there anything schooling-wise kind of coming up where you ended? Like for me growing up,
mm-hmm.
sports was kind of like my thing.
Yeah.
Education, unfortunately, I didn't have the mindset to be like, hey, I'm interested in this. Art and kind of music and sports was kind of where I rested. But for you, was there anything outside of sports that school-wise was piquing your interest? Because like you said, IT, very specific space,
yes,
not even in your wheelhouse until later on in life.
That's right. Yeah, good question. So, no. I mean, the honest answer there is no. I would say that music as a hobby was really big for me. My father was, a professional musician in the New York Symphony, the Durham-Raleigh Symphony for a long time. My mom was an actress off-Broadway, and that's how they met. He was actually playing in one of her shows in New York. And so they met that way, kind of in showbiz. And so my mother continued to act after I was born. And, you know, she was, full-blown musicals and performer. She was phenomenal. And, did some soaps. Then my father, continued to play in the symphony more as a hobby. But he was a bassoonist. And he taught me how to play the piano at a very young age. And so, I've been playing piano now for about 30 years.
Really?
And never really took it to the next level in terms of getting into a band or learning how to read, music very well. It was really just hear it, sound it out, play my version of it, get other people around us involved and singing along to it as a fun hobby. But I'm definitely passionate about that part, and I was as a kid too. And realistically, I mean, school was just kind of a drag for me. It really was. I love the friends that were involved there, but in terms of, man, I was never, ever a great student. I was your typical B and C student, more like B minus C student.
Yeah.
Where I really got my fuel and my, my fire from was being around teammates and sports.
So seeing your parents growing up, coming from music and then also acting, right? Both very intensive, very kind of driven industries.
Mm-hmm.
Was that where you started to see kind of the hard work kind of starting getting instilled in you? Were you lazy as a kid? Were how were you in that mindset?
Yeah. So my father worked, as I'm sure a lot of people's did out there, especially at that time during the 80s, 5 days a week in the city. So he'd go to Boston, he'd go to New York, and we would see him on the weekends. And that wasn't really something that kind of hit me at the time. But yeah, for the first like 14 or 15 years, we'd see my dad on the weekends. It was completely normal. So to me, what that said is that he was working hard and he was, you know, willing to take that much time and devote it to work. So I always had that grind, that work hard mentality. You know, my mom, you know, Monday through Friday would just watch the kids and do all the carpool, the PTA, all that crap, right? So she was always busting it out, up early, in bed late, just knocking it out. And it's not like we had tough times or anything like that. We were blessed, just a, you know, straight up kind of middle class, you know, kind of family. So it was one of those where I think I got a lot of my hard work probably as a result of my coaches and my teammates saying how much they needed me to perform in certain times or, you know, certain moments in the game. And I would put a lot of that pressure on my shoulders, and I kind of liked that.
Yeah.
I always loved being the hero in that. That was my favorite thing. And you know, when I didn't execute, man, it would crush me. But when I did, there was no better feeling. And I think based on the results I was getting, it was positive enough to where it kept me going nonstop grinding. And I have just recently, over the last few years, been able to really enjoy the process and not think about the source or the destination as much.
Yeah. And it sounds like your parents were performing in one way, you were performing on the field.
That's right.
So you liked the pressure, you liked all that.
Absolutely.
So you're coming up in high school, you're playing great ball, mm-hmm. you're getting recognition. So you shifted from tennis to baseball really.
Correct.
More.
Yep.
Which, by the way, for people that can't see this right now, you're definitely not the build of a tennis player.
No.
Definitely the build of a baseball player. I'm about to do push-ups after this. But so with that being said, you're getting a lot of attention. Schools yep. are looking at you. Where do you kind of start getting interest from? Where
yeah.
do you start looking at, okay, what's the next step in decision?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, being from up north, I didn't really understand what East Cobb baseball was. And for those that don't know that are listening, East Cobb is, you know, one of the premier, you know, non-high school affiliated baseball programs in the South. It was you know, built by a guy named Gary Baldwin, who's a phenomenal, you know, leader. We had a lot of coaches that ended up going off to the Braves organizations and, you know, coaching a lot in school and whatnot. So I grew up in this system of amazing ball players, you know, being coached and trained by, you know, that system, and then being put on teams with the likes of Corey Patterson from the Cubs. So I was always playing at a high level in high school. And I would say that if I were to, you know, looking back on it, I was given a bunch of scholarships to some D2 schools, Winthrop, Wingate, kind of like me and you were talking about in that same general area. Elon College in 2003 went to D1. And that at that time, they had the bat rule changed from a drop 5 to a drop 3. And what that means is, you know, length versus width. So a 33-28 for me was now a 33-30. And when you're facing 90, 92 mile an hour pitches instead of 84, 85, that's the difference between a rip and a foul ball. Wasn't able to catch up to that. Wasn't able to perform that well in summer ball. Well, wasn't as fast, wasn't as strong, wasn't as good as the rest of those D1 ball players. And that was a true awakening for me that looked at the difference between a traditional D2 ball player and a D1 ball player. The difference is big. And ironically, that was what did it in for me. I kind of lost interest not being the man. I wasn't as good as those guys, and it just kind of bummed me out. And so, and I learned something about myself, and that if I wasn't, you know, one of the stars of the show at that time in my life, I really wasn't that interested. So I transitioned to rugby, and I played rugby the rest of the time in school and a little bit after school. And I was big, and I was dumb, and I wouldn't mind running into people. Didn't have a care for the world for my body. You know, I'd like to party. I like to drink, like most rugby players do. So I fit the mold of that, even though I had zero clue how to play the game.
Yeah.
And that was, but that's how it all came full scale.
Got it. So when you ended up not kind of being able to take it to the next level in baseball, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up going to Elon.
Right.
Was this something, and I assume that you went to the school specifically because of the fact of sports, so education
yes.
probably was not like the leading factor at this point.
Right.
Was this kind of like the first hurdle or thing in your life from that standpoint where you're like, okay, I have to make a decision, and is this going to either keep me down and I'm going to quit sports or go into rugby, like you said? Because when you're used to kind of being the guy
mm-hmm.
in sports, and this is common for a lot of athletes, I think, that come up through programs, and then you get to that level and you're not the main talent, it's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was. And the reason I think that quite honestly made it easier was when I got involved with some of the friends that you and I know well. So when I was in high school, I had a few friends, right? It was I went to a small school, and we'll get into that later. Got into a lot of trouble and ended up getting into a small school towards the end of high school. So I didn't have a large group of friends. I went to college and learned that I was popular. I learned that I was funny, and I learned a lot of these things. I mean, I had a girlfriend in high school, maybe two total. And then I go to college and there was thousands of girls. You know, in high school, there was like 10. And so anyway, it was one of those moments where I got my passion for the first time through my peers and through friends and through girls and whatever the hell, and parties and whatever that is. And sports, for the first time in my entire life, took a significant backseat. And that was probably healthy.
Yeah.
In hindsight, because of the level of commitment and however many years. And it was really funny, Justin. I mean, how quickly I burnt out once I found how much fun life could be with friends and all that. And look, that's the difference between the best athletes in the world and the guys that get their joy somewhere else. I mean, these guys can just, they've got such a good balance of being able to live a fun, fulfilled, satisfied life, and they get it, but they don't sacrifice their craft for a second.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And their God-given talent doesn't help. I'm sorry, helps even more.
Yeah.
And so that's what I kind of replaced it with.
Okay, so you had something during that time to fill that void.
Correct.
All right, so for those, you know, sometimes people do go through those moments, they don't have those secondary items, right? It's interesting because I've heard a few people where the friendships really kind of fill that void.
Yeah.
I think it's also having the right friends too, right? People True. that you're around that are going to inspire you, encourage you. Because if it's the wrong friends, you could also fall into negative patterns.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. I know that all too well. And that happened to me exactly the way that you said it the minute I moved to Atlanta. So as I told you, small New England town, there was 9,000 kids in the whole place.
Wow. Right?
There was 4,000 kids in this high school that I went to.
Quite a culture shock.
I mean, it just, and speaking of that kind of same kind of idea, I was the man up there because I was a big fish in a small pond. And I moved down here and it was just like some New England Yankee kid. And I just got picked on and made fun of and ridiculed and bullied. And man, it was terrible. And so I got super pissed about moving to Atlanta. I thought this place sucked. You know what I mean? I was like, get me out of here. And what that turned into was meeting the wrong friends. I gravitated towards the first people that really showed me some love, and they were bad people.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
They were involved in just bad, bad stuff. So I spent roughly 3 years in the dirt, as I call it. You know, it got into drugs, stealing, got into just really, really terrible, terrible behavior at a young age. I mean, I was doing some pretty serious drugs when I was 14 years old, and that's just ridiculous. So I got kicked out of school my freshman year and, you know, drug out of the class, arrested in public, the whole deal was terrible. So, you know, come home and I've got this mother and father that just love me, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They've done nothing wrong here besides move us to this town, which was not a wrong thing to do. It's just, that's life, right?
Yeah.
I just didn't adjust. And then, you know, got, you know, put in rehab for a long time. And that was a good thing, more behavioral than it was really a drug problem at that point, to be honest with you. And then, you know, got out, was okay for a second, got let back into this other private school somehow, made actually for the first time in my life, started making some good grades, playing sports, varsity sports, the whole deal, made a big mistake, got into it again, started, you know, kind of pushing weight and dealing in the school and all that crap, and just really got into some more bad habits, got caught, got ratted on, got caught, and, you know, started threatening the guy, and it was just, I mean, anybody who's listening to this right now is cracking up because they had no idea about the stuff that I used to be. That's all about,
yeah,
right?
So I mean, I had zero.
Yeah.
I mean, if I could put a face and a person to this, you would be the last person.
Yeah.
What I guess intrigues me about that is, you know, it's funny. We talk about certain people mm-hmm. that are in our lives and kind of the impact. You are one of the people that when I speak on, I always say, you're probably one of the best human beings I know. Like, just a good individual and a good person. Not saying these things you do in the past are making anything of a bad person, sure. but not what I would ever have imagined. Yeah. What I'm curious about is seeing who you are now and kind mm-hmm. of what you've done. You know, great job, great family, just a good person, good friends.
Yeah.
What allowed you to kind of pivot, right? Mm-hmm. And how long did that process take? Because I think a lot of people are looking for, what's the quick fix? What's the quick answer? I want it now.
Yep.
I'm sure this wasn't an easy journey. I'm sure this didn't happen overnight.
It didn't. You know, after I got kicked out of that other school, which, you know, we my friends joke about it now, the ones that know me well, because they call me the four high school kid because I went to four high schools in 4 years due to my behavior. What got me out of it was my mom. My mom, God rest her soul, she was the youngest of seven sisters. She never met her parents. Her parents both overdosed.
Wow.
And I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. She definitely knew her parents. What I meant was her parents both overdosed when she was a young age. She didn't get to know her parents as an adult. And so that drugs to her, big red flag.
Yeah.
Let alone her firstborn son that's going through all this stuff. So. She, you know, I basically really started being aware of the pain that it was causing her. And this is a woman that I would have done anything for. No matter how much of a, you know, shithead I was, there was always mom, you know? And if she was ever in pain or in danger or anything like that, I was very, very hyper aware. So when I saw what it did to her, I put myself in her shoes for the first time in about 2 or 3 years. And I put myself in her shoes and I was like, what if my parents literally killed themselves by accident doing the same kind of crap that I'm doing right now? What is this doing to her? And really that moment of awareness was it. It was a long time to get that awareness. But then at that point, it was quick. I mean, it was as quick as I'm talking ditching everybody that I used to know, changing my beeper number. You remember beepers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Changing my beeper number and, you know, all that stuff. It was truly shutting the door on the past, not forgetting it, but shutting the door, removing a lot of, old friendships, doing my best to get back into school, doing the best to get back into to working and staying busy. And that's the reason why I reflect on this and looking at, did I have a drug problem or did I have a behavioral problem? And I would probably lean towards the latter, based on what I was getting into. I really, Justin, had a really tough time in high school with peers and friends because of the fact that it started off terrible.
Yeah.
You know, and that really set me for a bad, bad loop. So when I pivoted into, becoming, you know, a respectable teenager at that point. I was roughly 17 years old, and it was very funny to watch a lot of the people that were around me. They were just starting to consider getting into some of these bad habits, just starting to consider trying and experimenting with some of these things that I'd done for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I think that, you know, the fact that I started early and got done early is an absolute blessing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Absolute blessing. And I give the credit, obviously to God, for sure, that pulled me out of that. But you know, my mother was, God was speaking through my mom that day, and I'll never forget it.
Well, you know, it's what I like to hear too, is like you went through those 3-4 years, like you were saying, that were a really rough patch. And a lot of people think I can't change or I've gone too far. You know, there's no way to get out.
Yeah.
It seemed like when you had that moment of clarity, you're like, today's my day that I start.
That's it.
And I think sometimes people may overthink it, right? Or they think, I've already done wrong. But I think not enough people live in the now.
Yep.
Like, what is in this present moment that I can change moving forward?
Right.
But I agree with you. I think it's also a blessing to start earlier in some cases.
Yes. Because,
you know, even I think talk about this, growing up in South Florida and different stuff, you're exposed to things earlier. Things are seen quicker. By the time you get to college, you're like, I'm over it.
Yeah.
Not really into
this. Been there, done that.
So I think there's pros and cons to it all. And I don't think there's one perfect path, obviously, right? We all have, I think, and everybody I've kind of interviewed on these podcasts have had like these one to two pivotal moments in their life that have completely reshaped it. And I think we all hit these forks in the road, and it's what decision do we make there that dictates the rest of our life?
Yeah.
Because you could have gone the complete other way.
Yep.
But something in that case said, I'm going to go and correct this pretty much.
Yes.
Whether it be a parent, whether it be a friend, there has to be something. And I think sometimes we don't look enough for it, or we're just thinking people don't care when that's not the case.
That's exactly right. And I think that last part is very, very common. You know, and I don't know what people struggle with the most. If it's something that they internalize with, you know, with an addiction, you know, with irrational thought behavior, with depression, whatever it is, they're not willing to be vulnerable enough to put it out there and ask for some help. Some people just end up getting caught, and it forces to be out there like me. You know what I mean? I just got caught a lot. By the grace of God, I got caught a lot. And that was the reason why it was out there for me. So, yeah, I mean, it is really remarkable when you, especially with family and, you know, some friends, some specific friends. Yeah, I mean, you do have to get it out. And once you get it out, it's remarkable how much people not just want to help, but get something out of helping. You know what I mean? And that's how you find out who you need to be around.
Yeah. You know? So you're on the up and up at this point. Things are looking good.
Yes.
Move from baseball to rugby.
Yep.
During college at Elon, you study business.
Yes.
And is it international?
Yeah, it was a minor in Spanish. So yeah, okay. International business management.
Okay. So what made you gravitate towards that?
I don't know if there was any method to that madness. I did know that I wanted to go into business, that I didn't. And really back then, I mean, I don't quote me on this, but I don't know how many different types of majors there were at Elon. I know there wasn't a bunch of crazy specialty majors. You know, you had your sports management, you had your communications. Business was, you know, finance, international, management, et cetera. And I think business management was the most bland, basic way to get through a business school. And that's the one I put. That's the one I picked.
Got it.
Quite honestly.
I mean, I think that's fair. But what's interesting is a lot of this stuff, international especially, ends up playing a role later on in life.
I know it. Isn't that funny? Because so many times, I don't know what you majored in, but so many times you don't end up going to, you know, to do anything related to your major.
I majored in communications.
Okay.
But well, it was like ad PR, but mine was different. I got into it very similar reason to you. I was a soccer player.
Yep.
Didn't really care for education.
Right.
Was getting ready to drop out when I was 19 because I wanted to be in the music business.
Okay.
Ended up getting admitted to this program, long story short. And I was like, you're going to tell me I get graded on speaking versus having to do like tests and stuff because I just need to do PR and marketing. And they're like, I was like, all right, that sounds cool to me. And ended up graduating, not wanting to do it because I was like, well, you don't make money in this field. This is really attractive. It's not sexy. And then tried to not do it. And then here I am, you know, 11 years later.
That's
doing it.
Awesome. Yeah.
So somehow it always comes back.
Exactly.
Or you realize that there's a reason that kind of put you that way.
Yep.
So you end up doing that. You end up graduating.
Yep.
Okay.
I did. On time.
On time.
On time, which is great. From high school and, well, college at that point, I had kind of figured it out. But, yeah, one thing that I still look back on and I shake my head at because I really don't understand it is how I got through high school on time, you know, without, you know, any summer programs. But, you know, I was a grinder.
Yeah.
And that's what I was doing.
Just putting in the work.
Just, you know, as subconscious as it was, putting in the work. And then, yeah, graduated 2003 from Elon University. It became a university at that point. And yeah, moved right back to Atlanta. Got to work.
What made you come back to Atlanta?
The fact that at that point, Charlotte and Atlanta were the two biggest job markets that were hiring. And if you remember that 2002, 2003, it was tough to get a job.
Yeah.
It was really tough. So I ironically was an intern at the same company that I came on board with. And that was my junior year summer going into senior year. And the whole summer was about training for the next season, getting big and strong, eating a lot, you know, because I was in a position called the flank, which basically meant that I had to hold the scrum together and be able to run through people, which was a lot of fun for me. I'm not going to say my meathead days because people would still call me that, but my more meathead days then. And then I was an intern at the organization, the IT company that we were at, and just hustled, just called a billion people, worked the hours, never stopped calling, never stopped prospecting. I didn't even know what I was doing. but I was just going after it, and I put my name on a handful of deals, and those deals started to pay. And so I was in college getting checks, and that was a new thing to me, obviously. And I got a job offer my senior year, Thanksgiving of my senior year, which was a blessing and a curse, because it was a blessing because it was, you know, it was job security in a very tough market, 6 months ahead of graduation. But the bad part is all I had to do at that point was pass. So it was just a party for 6 months. You know what I mean? C's and D's would get it done as long as I got a cap and gown, get my way out of there.
And this job offer was in IT?
Correct.
Okay.
Sales specifically.
And then what made you go towards there? Was it just the first opportunity that was given to you?
That's correct. So, and the fact that I had seen some lucrative result based on the work that I had put in.
Gotcha. But to initially even get into IT, what even made you apply for even an internship?
That's a good question. So I was at a Super Bowl party, and I was just watching the game. Let's see, this was probably 98. Maybe it was Falcons. Falcons, who's that, Bronx? No, Falcons Bronx? Who was that?
I think so.
I think it might have been Falcons Bronx, yeah. So I was at that Super Bowl party, and there was a guy next to me, and we just started hitting it off, shooting the shit, and his name was Bill Warner, and he was the president of the organization that I went and interned for, and consequently when it ended up, you know, working for the next 5-6 years. It was truly a time and place, just dumb luck, really just dumb luck. And he was like, you seem like someone that can sell, you seem to talk well, you seem to have a good attitude, have you ever thought about sales? And I was like, sure. And he's like, you ever thought about IT? And I was like, no. You want an internship? Sure. That was it.
So a lot of this, I'm curious, how much do you think of it as on luck and time in life, period?
Yep. I think a ton of it is.
Yeah.
I don't know another reason, because quite frankly, I was not putting myself out there to get hired. I was being myself in the moment and making a friend who ended up having a little bit of vision for me, and he gave me an opportunity, and I took it. It was one of those things in college too, where you got a few credits for having an internship. So that was a goal, to acquire an internship. And based on it being in sales at a job that sounded like people make a lot of money, I was not about to turn that opportunity down at that point.
So money was the driver.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is nothing wrong. As a young kid, you're sitting there like, hey, I just want to, you know, get that check.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then, you know, a lot of times people get presented opportunities, but they don't take them, or they're like, it's not what I want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from a guy that kind of mentored me in college is, I remember going out, he got me all these interviews set up, and I was like, this is not for me, too corporate.
Yeah.
You know, I want, and he's like, you're looking for this perfect job. And I was like, yeah, man, because, you know, at this time, I think I know what I'm talking about. I'm 21. I want to, like, be balling, and this is, like, the life.
Yeah.
And he goes, man, you just need your first job to get your second job. And I was like,
oh, that's good advice.
All right. I like solid, that. Man. Solid.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think a lot of times people probably miss out on opportunities thinking that this is the end-all, be-all. Or look at what happens, right? You meet this guy. You have a conversation. You never know who you're speaking to. This is your introduction into the space, only to lead to a business that's formed years later.
Yep.
That you could have never even envisioned.
No, you're exactly right. And further on to what you said, I think that, you know, people of all ages need to understand the 80-20 when it comes to your job, J-O-B. 20% of it's going to suck, okay? Everybody's got to deal with that. Things come up, fires happen, you know, people have bad days. Sometimes you get treated poorly. 20% of it isn't perfect. You know what I mean? It maybe sucks too harsh of a word. Maybe 20% of it is the type of grind that people don't like. And 80% of it should be something that they enjoy. And that's pretty much my rule for anybody that's ever worked for me, for anybody that I coach, for anybody that I, you know, give advice to. If they are in a professional job where it's 80-20, they should be thankful, grateful, and that's normal. And not to think that that's terrible.
Yeah.
You know?
And then when you started signing these deals as a young kid, because you're still in college,
right,
when you're signing some of these big deals,
yep,
what was making it effective for you? What were you doing that you were seeing now that you look back on? Because then you don't even know. You're in it.
Yeah.
But what was the tactics or the tools that you were using that was closing these deals?
Yeah. So I think it was really a lot about personality. And and being there and being present and like really just showing up. I showed up to every conference call, to every meeting. If I scheduled, you know, a coffee or a dinner or a lunch or whatever it was, I didn't miss that for anything. I showed up looking the part. I showed up attentive. I showed up, you know, asking questions. I was very Socratic in my approach. And at a young age, that's tough to do, I feel like. And I see it now a lot of times because people get into a meeting at all ages. I've got 30-something-year-olds that do this, and they just go gangbusters, straight into sales mode. Here's what we got. Here's what we got. Here's what we got. And what people, you know, in my opinion, from what I've seen, that's a very tough sale because people don't want to be sold. They want to be educated. You know what I mean? They want to see what's in it for both of them. If you're not creating a win-win, then I don't think that you're really, you know, helping yourself or you're not helping them. If your goal is to make a sale and to make a transaction and have it be very, you know, pop and move on, you're not doing your customer any service whatsoever.
What do you think gave you that thought that at such a young age, that what made you think like that?
I would say that I have always really been dialed in to if I help someone and I get some sort of feedback from that, that is really where how I get my self measure. So for instance, if I sit down with you and we have a plan on how we're going to, and this is a bad example because you're a hell of a runner. Hell of a runner is a really terrible example. But if I sit down with you and we talk about how we're going to eat better and lose weight and, you know, how we're going to, you know, work out, and we have this plan, and then you go do that plan and you have results and it makes you happy, that to me is the most fulfilling thing that I can have. I don't need a thank you. I don't need a you're the best. But if we have this thing and you go execute on that, I'm the happiest in the world because you're happy. So I feel like when I was talking to the customers, if for instance, they get some praise for saving a lot of money in the procurement efforts or for completing a project better on time or for getting a lot of great feedback from all their different project managers all over the world, and it helps them financially or morally, you know, however, that to me, that is the best thing in the world. And I am positive when I'm talking about organization currently that I'm giving them that possibility. So it'd be one thing if you didn't believe that your organization could fulfill that kind of prophecy, but I do. And that's not just from a biased point of view. We have grown the culture of our organization to think that exact same way, and not just to be concerned with revenues, not just to be concerned with profitability, not just to be concerned with execution, but all three in a very healthy way.
You know, I think what's super interesting, right, is the gratitude aspect that you like to receive on that mm-hmm. regard. And this is why I always like to talk to people about how they came up, how they were raised, what they went through, family background, because what's interesting is what I'm hearing is almost what you saw growing up as a child. Father musician, mother actress. What are you doing? You're giving people joy, right? By mm-hmm. performing, by educating, by giving them something to kind of not even say thank you, but to fill a certain need.
Yeah.
Sports. You like the role of being kind of the person that could put the things on the back and people appreciating that and helping them out, giving them a plan in a different regard. Now it's just translating the business for you.
I like the way you say that. I've never thought about it in that way. But I think you're right. I mean, my parents are serial givers. You know, my mother, gosh, we housed every single one of my delinquent friends and gosh, all of the pets that my siblings would abandon because they couldn't afford them. She was always just giving and giving and giving. My father's the same way, just a little more introverted about it. That's just been a thing for us. And we do love people's reactions to it. If there wasn't that reaction and it didn't bring them joy or bring them, you know, satisfaction or, influence them in a positive way, man, that would change the course of our entire lives.
That's your true currency.
Yes, that is absolutely my true currency. I am a, if you guys are Enneagram fans, I am a 2 to the max. And that is that is what's called the helper. And the balance that I have to make sure that I understand a lot of times, and anybody that knows me is listening to this right now is probably laughing. Many people come to me for advice, for help, for personal and professional gain, whatever it is. And I give advice based on them asking for that. Other people come to me, might just want to talk, might just want me to listen. But I am so used to being in this fixing mode that I get into this advice monster. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It is if people ask for it, maybe. But there is absolutely some awareness that people like me need to have and understand if it's a fixing moment or a listening moment. And man, that's, I mean, from my personal point of view, I work on that every single day.
So you now are at this internship that turns into a job.
Yep.
You're there for 5-6 years?
Yeah, 4 or 5 years. Yeah.
Okay. And you're kind of evolving. I'm sure you're kind of seeing the growth.
Yep.
If you're already performing that high right when you get in, you're probably doing amazing now. Now you start to say, okay, do I want to continue with this company? Do I want to go off and do something else? What's your next thought in this plan?
Yeah. So it was January 2007. We had recently been acquired by a private equity group and all the non-competes went out the window. So me and who are my business partners now had been talking about it for a little while, and it was time. It was time at that moment. If we were going to do it, it was going to happen then. So we did, and that was 2007. And we were in a building. We were in a basement in our CFO's basement at the time, just grinding away on cell phones and just trying to make anything happen. Moved into the Lennox buildings over here. And we've been in Norcross since roughly 2009. And you know, by the grace of God, we hired the right people. We, you know, created enough, you know, of a customer base, of a customer retention, pivoted when the market called for it. You know, basically the gist of that is that, I mean, the IT business was really hit by the Uber model, you know, with the cloud and virtualization. I mean, there's less equipment out there based on what's going on right now in the cloud. And if we stuck to truly a hardware, you know, provider, man, we get squashed. Plenty of people did get squashed. So one thing that I'll say about us as an organization, as a team, that I think was really good is having the foresight to know when to pivot into that services organization that's a little, you know, more recession or cloud proof than the traditional hardware only model.
Yeah. Now, what made you guys, though, want to say, I'm going to go and start my own business? Because most people, okay, you know, you're making good money.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, non-compete ends. Most people go, well, now I have a resume. I'm going to go work from somebody else. In a lot of cases,
yeah,
I'm not going to take a pay cut and try to start something from the ground and up out of the basement.
Yeah.
You have to be a special type of person to want to do that.
Absolutely. So for me, it was a status thing. I was 25 years old, and I was like, this is a chance to be a business owner. I'm in. And that was more arrogance and ego probably than anything else. Number two are the closest friends that I had at the organization that were doing this. I truly trusted them, and they were older than me. You know, they were, one of them that left was our director of sales, who I still work for today. He's the president of our new organization. And he's a phenomenal, phenomenal leader, a guy that I would follow into war, quite honestly. So he was a big reason why I left as well. If you were to ask all of us that question, we would have two answers collectively, which is that the private equity group that we were acquired by had visions for this organization to take it into one specific lane. And we fully disagreed with that. The other part of that is that we wanted to start our own company. That plain and simple, we wanted to work for ourselves. We wanted to start something special, leave a legacy, you know, have our name on something. And just in the true entrepreneurial spirit, start something ourselves.
So when you end up starting it yourself, right? And okay, now it's go time.
Yep.
You got to perform and deliver.
Yep.
Did you have a very clear plan? Were you kind of going in with just an open mind? Like, what was the thought? Because when you speak about it, it sounds very intentional. Like, this is what we're going to do. Name is going to be on the door. We're going to make this happen. It's going to be big. Even your exiting strategy sounds like we exited because we knew where it was going. And
right,
even based on your service offering now, it sounds like you were looking at trends, forecasting, and pivoting. And
right,
one of the things I tell our team at the agency all the time is pivot is a word to live by.
Yes.
Nothing goes according to plan.
You're right.
So I'm curious, were you just hell-bent on like, this is how it's going to go, I see it as clear as day,
mm-hmm,
or was it, I believe in the people around me, or was it like, what do I got to lose?
So I think, and it was 2007, and as you remember, 2008 hit, and that was a—
Not a good year.
Not a great year.
Yeah.
So
you tend to pick years that are not good
great
to
years.
Start new
yeah.
ventures.
Exactly. So 2007, the market was good in terms of the secondary market hardware, you know, industry, right? It was a multi-billion dollar industry. We knew that a lot of our customers would come with us. We thought we were walking into this new organization with a pretty solid book of business. We didn't think we'd spend much time in court. So I would say number one, we didn't have necessarily a vision on maybe which go-to-market strategies we were going to have, but we had equipment. We knew how to sell it. We knew who to sell it to. We knew where to buy it from. So on a brokerage side of things, we were very, very comfortable, and the market supported what we were doing very well. 2008 hit. That, generally speaking, is a good thing for us in our business, based on the fact that everything is secondary market. So everybody wants to go buy, you know, returned equipment, you know, whatever it is, used equipment, refurbished equipment. That was another good aspect of it. The answer, did we have a vision on potentially, if I even want to say, where we're at today? Hell no, not even close. We believed in the people around us. We believed in the people that we hired, but we truly have always been a commission only type of an organization, especially for our top dogs, the salespeople, that is. And that's how we did it. We put all of our money in it together. Everything that we've done is 100% organic. We've never grown by acquisition or merger or taken any outside funds. And that's by design. That gives us, you know, kind of the freedom and flexibility to go into these things that I'm talking about right now. And that was a big, big reason why we wanted to leave, because we were going to get stuffed into a box if we stayed.
So you talk about commission type jobs, right? Mm. Takes a very special type of person to kind of get through those storms and succeed. What are the three things a person needs to be successful in a commission-based job? Not even just IT, across the board.
Good question. What are the three things that people need to be successful in a commission-only? I would say number one is discipline. Hands down, discipline. Because as you know, there is 24 hours in a day. You can choose what to do with them. But if you don't have a plan that supports your own belief systems or your own organizational, you know, maneuvers, then you're sunk. So discipline is hands down number one. I would say acceleration is number two. I mean, you've got to be able to feel when the market's turning. You've got to be able to recognize an opportunity, know when to take a risk, know when not to take a risk, accelerate whatever that is. That could be education, that could be, you know, taking chances, but you've got to be able to accelerate. And then number three, I think you've got to be able to continually improve. I think you've got to be able to look back at what you've been doing, successful or not, measure yourself, adjust, you know, and lather, wash, rinse, repeat.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are good things for people, especially the discipline part.
Yes.
It's the hardest part for most people.
Yes.
So when you got into the new venture in 07, you start this, are you at this point, is this like your passion project still? Are you still like, I love IT or I love the money, or is it just, I love the idea of creating a business?
It was the latter. It was, I love the idea of creating a business and one day we'll sell it and make a lot of money. Right?
Yeah.
That was it. And to be clear, this was never designed to be a lifestyle business, this adventure that we're on. This was designed to create jobs for a lot of people that we know and love. There's a lot of different people that we eventually got to know and love. Mm-hmm. And it's turned into much more of a lifestyle gig based on the family that we've created. However, the organization as a whole was started with the idea of having an entrepreneurial background and a spirit to it, doing things the way that we wanted to, and basically create this empire of an IT solutions company.
See, I think what's interesting is you hear a lot of these things, podcasts, books, speeches, and everybody talks about follow your dream, follow your passion. I'm a big believer of that.
Yeah.
But I also think there's another side to it, which is if you have goals, if you want to achieve certain things, not everybody's goal is living a lifestyle, like you said,
right,
or having this like really sexy, attractive job. Sometimes it's just creating a viable, performing, culturally fit business.
Yeah.
And in your mind, that is what you knew you wanted to do.
Yes.
And I think people need to understand that sometimes is you don't have to look for this dream situation or what you think is a dream.
Right.
You need to look at where do I want to be? What do I want to achieve? And kind of put it on paper. And it sounds like you never really deviated from that. And you talk about discipline. It sounds like you were super, super disciplined of, I want to create a business. I want to create profit. I want to create a wonderful organization. I want to impact lives.
That's it. I mean, Justin, you just hit the nail on the head. Those four things were the reasons. Technology was the product. That's it. The only passion that we had lived in those first four things that you talk about. And it's not that we don't enjoy talking about technology, especially nowadays with all the cool stuff going on. It's becoming cool to talk about, no doubt. But back then, no, it was about those four things, regardless of what we sold. And that's the way that I train everybody that comes on board. Forget what we do for a second, okay? Now let's talk about the things that are going to make a successful business. Now insert this product there.
Yeah.
And then you've got it.
Well, it sounded like you started where I think a lot of people do mess up. You started with the why. And these are the whys of why we want to do what we want to do.
Right.
While people instead look for they're looking backwards. It's like what I want to get.
Yeah.
Not so much why I'm in this.
Right.
And I think most people don't look at their opportunities. If you say to somebody right now, what would be your dream job? And some of them sit there and they'll say, oh, I want to be this.
Right.
But if you ask why, do they really understand why they want to be in that space?
Yeah. Good question. We should go out and try that because my assumption is no. And I agree with you. I think a lot of people get hung up on that. And you know, man, I think a lot of people get hung up on the entrepreneurial idea too. I mean,
which is way overrated, by the way.
It is. It 100% is. And I'm not trying to tell anybody that it's a terrible idea. I mean, that'd be hypocritical of me to say, but I also knew that I was not going to be number one. I am not a great number one. I might be a great number two or three or four, but I'm not a good number one. And people get hung up on that. People get hung up on the fact that they just want to be an entrepreneur because they want to say that they're a founder and an entrepreneur and this and that. And the status of that makes them feel great when they don't really understand that they could be satisfied and fulfilled by being a hell of a number two or three and let somebody else who might be like the innovator of the group take over that stuff. I look at this five guys that we started a business with. There was no doubt who was going to be our number one. And that was something that I mean, from my point of view, I never, ever had an issue with. And now I'm almost 40 years old and I look at, you know, if we were to start this whole thing over again, I wouldn't change a thing. I would not change a thing and want to start my own organization doing exactly what I'm doing now with me being number one. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I don't consider myself entrepreneurial. Doesn't mean that at all. It just, there is more to it than just what I think a lot of these young people are getting at. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, I think the word entrepreneur, people look at it as like one vertical, which is I'm an entrepreneur because I start a business and my name's on the door. I think an entrepreneur is multiple things. It can take the risk to join a company, to come up with concepts within that group. I tell our team all the time, I want you to be entrepreneurs. You may work for a company that has our name or I may be on the paperwork, but let's be real. If you're coming up with programs, divisions, concepts, ideas, I don't care if you're making new designs. That's entrepreneurial.
Yes.
It's dependent upon how you kind of put it together. And then why do you want to be an entrepreneur? You know, I think people think about the money, this and that. I always tell everybody that comes in here, I say, what do you want to be? I want to be an entrepreneur. Okay. I've done it my whole life. I support that. Do you want to have no balance of life?
Right.
Do you want to not have friends? Do you want to not go out on weekends? Do you want to put in the work?
Yeah.
Because everybody sees, and this is why I think, you know, culturation, a big part of it was started, is there's no such thing as an overnight success. It's a 20-year overnight success.
Absolutely.
And if you're willing to put in the work, and that's the common thing everybody comes in here to say, do the work.
Yeah.
But most people don't want to do the work. They just want the results.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So to me, that's why it's interesting to hear is like everybody has different reasons for wanting to go into these entrepreneurial modes. Some it's ego, which I think ego is good and bad. I think ego sometimes makes you take risks that you otherwise wouldn't. But I think it also could hurt you, like you said, which is if you had the ego and wanted to be the number one, the company could have gone a completely different direction.
Absolutely. Yep.
But you knew where you fit in.
That's right.
So now for this company, you're starting to get some success. You're moving into new buildings. The team is growing. Yep. You know, kind of at this point, how would you define Centrix IT? Like, what are you? What do you offer? What makes you different?
Yeah.
And then kind of what is the business about for those that go, well, IT could be anything.
Sure, sure. So number one, Centrix as a whole started off as a international distributor of hardware. That was it.
Okay.
Right. So the foundational elements are around the idea of hardware. However, that's just taken a massive spin into not necessarily only providing the hardware, but it's servicing the equipment. So the maintenance, the installation, the moves, adds, changes, the professional services involved in it, the recycling and the data destruction, all of those key life cycle service elements are what we do best. the reason why people come to us is because our target clients are those that go through multiple types of acquisitions every single year, that have got multiple locations, tons of users, tons of employees. And basically what the results of a lot of those things are is asset management nightmare, IT confusion, not much clue how to put it together, very decentralized in terms of decision making. And what we try to do is take that mess of a situation, which might include 50 different procurement organizations, 1,000 vendors, with, you know, and that's just in region. And then you've multiplied the regions all over the world and you've got kind of a mess. So our aim is to decrease the total cost of ownership, number one. It is to increase the level of service, number two, but significantly decrease the number of vendors in the process, number three. And that's what we do. So the lifecycle model that we're into right now with is involved in everything from discovery, as I call it, to disposal. We're doing it all over the world, but we have a goal of a solution in mind. We don't hang our hat on a product. We don't hang our hat on one individual type of service. It is truly a solution that is driven from the customer when they come asking for help. And we've got the subject matter expertise, the brains, the engineering brains, and then the service delivery group that just does it so well, you know, with quality in mind every single time.
You know, it's interesting. Even when you talk about the company and what you do, it's so definitive, right? The way you deliver it.
Yeah.
You don't really stray. This is like very, very strategic, well thought out. And honestly, I feel like this is why you do so well in the business that you do. I don't think it, like you said, I don't think it mattered if it was IT or selling popcorn.
Exactly.
And that's where I think sometimes people don't realize like the strength is in the capability of being disciplined. I think that's probably one of your greatest assets, right? Is the discipline, the personality.
Yes.
But you know what you're talking about.
Right.
And you can deliver. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that if you know with confidence, we are going to deliver what I'm saying, you can go in there and actually feel good about it.
Absolutely.
Versus just kind of winding the shit and saying, hey, we're going to do this and this, and then not delivering. And then you're
right.
Fielding calls of problems.
Yeah.
But I think this is why I say entrepreneurs, I think people need to open up their mindset of what that is defined as. Because what you do, I couldn't do in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the discipline in that type of mindset. I have discipline in my own crazy way, right?
I believe that.
But I think we need to look into our strengths. And I think a lot of times people, you recognize your strength early on. I think even when you were probably getting into the bad stuff, you were very disciplined
in doing the bad stuff. Yeah.
But I think if you can take that throughout life and apply it,
and
a lot of times I feel like we miss these things, right? I knew I had one thing. I had a gift of gab and connecting.
Yeah.
That was my thing. What I thought was normal, other people thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
For you, what people probably, you think is just easy, this is kind of what naturally is what it is. A lot of people would look at you and say, I wish I had that, or I wish I possessed that.
The ordinary versus extraordinary. Yeah.
It's a great point, right? And I think what I find super interesting too is that you find people that are in sales positions or in growth positions, and they're very, a lot of times, about me.
Mm-hmm.
What I find interesting about you is it's empowering others. And I think that's a big part of your company culture, not just in business, but in life through things you do philanthropy-wise, things you do in the community. Is that the stuff that you need to constantly fuel your soul?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I'm going to say yes. Absolutely it is. And again, this is maybe a me thing, but it really does go back to the fact that I feel like I was put on this planet to help men and women perform at a very high level. And I don't just mean that in the personal sense. I do believe it begins there. But I mean that in the professional sense as well. And, you know, the things that we talked about earlier around, you know, discipline and acceleration and continual improvement, you touched on it first. I think the very first step is authenticity. That's what we call it, the ADAC, A-D-A-C. It's authenticity, discipline, acceleration, and continual improvement. But if you don't know yourself well enough, or if you're not willing to know yourself well enough, and you just think that you're, you know, that you just want to start a business so bad because it's the cool thing to do, and you don't know yourself well enough, then people are going to see right through this. And people got to understand, there is no way to succeed as an entrepreneur if you don't have people all around you that you are influencing, whether they are customers, vendors, partners, software developers, investors, angel investors, whatever that is, you've got to have those people. And if you are not authentic, people are going to see right through you. So you need to be you need to understand, and you said it earlier, which was a great point. You need to understand your strengths. And when you have got your strengths figured out, capitalize. But if it's not in your strength, do not be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to pay for help. If you're this serious about being an entrepreneur, then you got to come out of pocket because you want this thing to work really well, and you need to pay for someone else's strength, which is a part of your weakness. And I say it all the time. And I mean, it's simple as this is, Justin, hearing somebody on a sales call. You know, if I'm bringing an SDR out and want to get him or her some experience, and they're up to introduce themselves, and they just kind of bottle up and they go, "Hi, I'm this and that. I work for that's not what they sound like."
Yeah,
it's not. And I always remind people of this. And so for all your salespeople out there, please hear me loud and clear. People are no different than people. They just want to be talked to like people, right? If you're unable to do that based on your based on the fact that you're nervous or based on the fact that you have anxiety. Look, I'm not saying that's not normal. Of course it is. No one loves the cold call. But what I will say is you've got to have, number one, a positive belief that you can help them. Positive, unwavering confidence that whatever you're going to tell them helps them. Because if you don't, that's going to be tough to pitch. So that's number one. Number two is just remember you're talking to somebody that you're going to help. That should be easy to do. If you walk up to somebody and you can say, "Hey, I can help you," as common as that is, as simple as that is, you need to be able to do that on a sales call. You have to. And if you don't, then I think you probably have got some authenticity work to deal with. And again, just remember, this is not just coming from me. These are people that can see through this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, I think the authenticity is probably one of the best things, right? Yeah. If you look at industries too, entrepreneurs, musicians, actors, the ones that are true to themselves and they don't have to think about how I need to be for others or how people want me to be are pretty successful.
Yeah.
They may be looked at as crazy,
yep.
But you know what? It's much easier to be you and not be a facade or try to put on a front. And I also think for you, I don't even know if the word sales really does you justice, because I feel like sales, and I think a big thing about today is, right, people want to figure out how to sell a product or get in the door or create an introduction. I don't know if that's even what you do.
Right.
I feel like what you do is almost figure out solutions, and I feel like it's more investing in people.
Mm-hmm.
A sale is a very basic transaction to seen by most people. You're truly investing into the individual. You're truly investing into what you want best. You don't look at it as like, I'm selling you a product today, and here's what this product's going to do.
Right.
You go, I have a product, and this is how I see it helping you.
Yes.
You, that individual, you, that particular business, not here's my blanketed statement.
Right.
And I think when you can help people, and you know, I've heard friends say this before, which is really interesting. It's such common sense, but it happens more than none. How many times, and I'm sure you get this, people reach out and say, I want you to help me with something, or I need, or I want. But a lot of successful people, it's so rare that people go to them, here's what I can do for you.
Yeah.
And I feel like if people went in, like you said, with that process of like, here's what I can do for you versus asking somebody for something, it's a complete, you're already changing how they're going to look at you.
Immediately.
Because otherwise you're selling them. Like you said, you're going in for the kill. There's no finesse. It's I want something from you. You're just a bottom line to me.
Yeah. And you've assumed you know what they want.
Correct.
Which you don't. You got to ask questions.
It's like going to a restaurant and telling somebody you're going to order that dish.
Right. It's absolutely like that.
And you're like, you don't even know. I don't even eat meat.
Or maybe you took them to the restaurant that they don't even like.
True.
You know what I mean? I mean, it goes down to, you know, a lot of it's just owning your craft. But I mean, if you put yourself in the client's shoes, if you put yourself in the partner's shoes, whoever you're talking to, whoever you're pitching this idea to, the investor's shoes, I mean, you really gotta, you know, you have to have, almost like Seth Godin says, you have to have people like us do things like this. It's an us thing. It's got to have this win-win feel to it. And if you're not able to talk to somebody in that kind of a transparent, authentic way, then it's going to feel like you're selling them.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to feel like you're just trying to get a transaction out of them. Get a dollar, move on, and that's really it. I mean, that is not, we are not here 12 years later because we know how to, sharpen the pencil by a few bucks.
Yeah.
We're not. We're here because we have rescued people from dire situations, that we've got brought companies back online in the middle of a massive transactional seasonal spike because we've solution thing so specific to their unique requirements. And at the end of the day, it's about them. We're just the guide. They're the hero. You know, we are an extension of their workforce. You know, we're not a vendor. We're just an extension of their workforce. And I try to translate that exact same thing personally to the individuals that I help.
Yeah.
I don't try to tell them everything that they're supposed to do. I try to help guide them. And I try to basically create and try to help them walk into this solution that's going to fit them the best. Yeah. But I honestly do think those four pillars are the foundational elements to doing it well.
So people are your passion.
Yes. Hands down.
Love it, man.
Yeah.
So company obviously is thriving right now. You guys are doing great global offices.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I know because of kind of the success and kind of your teachings, you have 10-week courses within your company
yep.
now that people
mm-hmm.
follow. I don't want to give away all the secrets of what those courses are like. but obviously you're doing something right and people are staying with you guys because it's more than a company. It's really people over profit in a lot
yeah.
of ways. And that's something that we stand by. So with that being said, 20 years in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, man, because I talk to so many people that are in specific industries and I'm so focused on their industry. I'm not really focused on your industry.
Yeah.
I'm really focused on your mindset.
Yeah.
Because I think like your mindset is what separates you. I don't think it mattered what you got into. You were going to make it happen based off of mindset and principle and intention.
Well, thank you.
That was it.
I like to think that too. So thank you for saying that.
So with that being said, what's next for you?
Yeah.
What do you have coming up? Business, life, personal, how do people find out more? All that good stuff.
Yeah, appreciate that. Number one is, I'm coming to the point now where, the business is still priority number one, you know, and I don't mean that in the scheme of life. I mean that in terms of professional activity, the business is number one. But what's nice about it nowadays, 12 years later, is the fact that I don't feel like I've been pulled too away from my family, my wife and my kids. My wife has been just I don't even know how to describe her. She's inhuman. She is just this. I'm going to build a statue of her one day, I think, because I mean, she puts up with a couple weeks in Europe for business development. She puts up with, you know, all the trips to Canada, to Mexico and these crazy places that I'm going, these dangerous places that I'm going to see if there's a marketability down there. And she puts up with all of it and really no tick for tack. And that's quite the reason why I think that we're so good together. I'm getting off topic. What's next for us? What's next for me definitely is some sort of bigger platform where the things that I have learned over the last 18 and 19 years professionally mixed with the things that I've learned my entire life personally, those two things can come together in what I call a rhythm. And if you can get those two things locked into a rhythm pretty well, the basic gist behind it is I think you're going to find life is better. And I think you're going to be better at life. And those things are, you know, foundational in those four elements that I talked about, but it's designed to help you physically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and equally, you know, not just one thing or not just two things, but truly a way that you can be very, very profitable without giving up your humanity, you know, and that's what I'm trying to build. That's what's next. And I don't have much more yet, but I am extremely, as you know, passionate about it. And I'm looking forward to giving it away.
Well, based on your track record and your discipline and your vision, I don't think you're going to have a problem building that. I don't. And I think, you know, it excites me whatever it turns into for
yeah.
you, because I think the biggest thing, and this is probably something that a lot of people are misguided about, and including myself up until, you know, thankfully my wife is able to put me in check in all
yeah.
these good, positive ways. I mean that. But balance of life was never something that I thought was realistic. When you become an entrepreneur, or you go into business, you think it has to be
right.
one-sided. I have to put 110%. I have to work my ass off. I don't sleep.
Right.
I'll dedicate some time to family, but this is number one. When I think now we're learning that you don't have to be that way.
No.
You can work hard, but work smart.
Exactly.
That you can have the family and that you could have the profitability and the passion, and you don't have to sell out
right.
to make it a choice.
Right.
And I think it sounds like what you're looking to kind of put together is, how do I create that perfect balance and blend?
That's right.
To where I'm gratified professionally, personally, and they also can work hand in hand together.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I'm sure a lot of people could use.
Yeah.
Including myself, probably. I'm definitely a work in progress. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, having good intentions, being a good person, and also the fact that you're doing things because you want to, not because you have to in your case, has led to your success.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And thank you, man. I am truly, truly humbled by what you said, and I'm very, very thankful. And, you know, and that's number one. I can't be preaching this stuff if it's chaotic in my own life.
Yeah.
I've got to practice, you know, what I preach. And you nailed it on the head earlier, which was working smart. I mean, I've employed people that have sat at the office staring at a computer for 14, 15 hours a day, and they say that they work 14 to 15 hours a day, and they're staring at a computer without doing anything. I've employed other people that are, you know, working 4 or 5 hour, ridiculously smart, strategic ways, and they're some of our top performers. There is the ability to do both, and it's up to you to figure out what you're going to do. Have the integrity like you're talking about, and the discipline in order to do it right. There's a gap. That gap between those two things is what I'm trying to fill.
So with all the gems you kind of dropped today, all the knowledge, what is, if somebody's listening to this, right? Mm-hmm. And I listen to this hour, and we'll probably be at a 10-minute episode. Yeah. And I take one piece of information from it. What is the one thing that you would want people to walk away with? That one lesson, that one thought, that one way to kind of keep in their head.
I would say, know thyself. I mean, I look at all of the high performance habits out there, and I'm even before you can get to deciding what your core beliefs are, you've got to know yourself. And it's got to be a full-blown, you know, it's got to be a war on inauthenticity. You've got to wage war on anything inauthentic in your life, and you've got to bring it all in. And I'm telling you that the source of strength that comes from that, that will peak your performance at home and at work, it begins with authenticity. That is number one.
I'll tell you, I think that is an unbelievable takeaway. And what I appreciate even more is that when I asked the question, you could very easily throw me some bullshit answer or answered quickly.
Yeah.
But the fact that you stopped, and this is something you don't see a lot of people do, and really think intentionally of what it means and then say it with conviction, I think that in itself is just another example of discipline, authenticity, and really speaking with a purpose versus just saying something to say it.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. I wanted to get that right. Well, that's important.
Listen, man, I appreciate you coming in today, Taylor. Man. Amazing, dude. Amazing. And I'm hoping that once again, you know, people can take away from this how to be a good person, profitable, but also still giving back, still doing the right thing, still having this kind of balance that you've created for yourself, and hopefully others will kind of start to create for themselves. Yeah. So.
And I hope they can too. I hope any message that we brought up today is extremely useful and helpful.
Amazing. And I'm going to go work out after this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So. I'll join you.
All right, man. Good to have you on, man.
All right. Thanks.
Once again, I'm your host, Justin Epstein, and thank you for listening to Culturation. As always, this show has been powered by Premiere.